Shalom lachem.
Hello, thank you for being with us in our New Life Educational Series with Rav Dr. Michael Lyman. Hello, Dr. Lyman. Hello, Nitzama Zuz. Hello. We're happy to be with you here to learn together from Rav Lyman how to take our lives to a new place, how we can take our relationships that is in the heart of our life to a new place, to a better place, a more connected place where things between us, instead of being stuck, they start to flow, where we complete one another, and we discover that suddenly everything just becomes good. Be with us. There'll be a lot to take from here. And in this series of New Life, we're trying to focus on a certain aspect of our lives, the insights that we receive. Based on my personal experience, you can apply them to other parts of your life. So now we're dealing with the family inside the home, and we want to see how to do things otherwise. Relations inside the family today is very painful. I don't think there's anything more painful in life than relations in the house, and we want to learn to do it well. Nitza, get us into our discussion today, please. So today we're going to focus on the relations between brothers. Until now, you spoke in the framework of parenthood about the relations between the parents, the relations between parents and children, and today we want to focus the discussion on the system that is woven between brothers. There's no question that the brotherly connections, it's one of the most significant connections in a person's life. It's actually the longest relationship. It starts before we get married. It ends usually after the parents have already left this world. And this relationship can have huge influence. When it's good, it can be a supportive system. It can be friendship, fun, hanging out together. And it can be the opposite. It can be a source of frustration, pain, suffering, etc. So today we want to learn with you, first of all, what does it mean, this relationship of brothers? What's the significance? Why is it so significant? And why does it leave so many impressions on us even when we get older? First of all, maybe we'll start with the fact that when we get older and we also become parents, then we begin to understand that this connection, brothers, between brothers, to be brothers, it's a connection that is natural. It comes from nature. You can't cut it. You can't do anything with it. You can't get divorced from it. It's a relationship that obligates us from our parents' side. Our parents want us to be brothers. They made us like that. Therefore, if we ruin this relationship between us, it's as if we're harming our parents. Therefore, the more that we get older ourselves, we maintain this connection slightly more because we do it for our parents' sake and we feel unpleasant about it. If we're talking about, let's say, after we become parents ourselves and onward. On the other hand, we see from the Torah, from the Bible, that we see examples, really bad examples. Esav and Jacob, they're brothers. What could be closer than two brothers? And look how opposite they are from one another. They're precisely Jacob because he made a round and didn't actually come out at the right time. He stole. It's as if he stole. He stole being the firstborn. There's still something in it. And in general, the sons of Jacob, how they're all between them, and especially toward Joseph, and relations like this, The Torah brings it to us like a natural problem, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we see that precisely if there's a connection between the brothers, it has to go through the parents. We see that when do Esav and Jacob meet? They come when their father dies, in situations like that where there's a connection between them, a natural connection. It obligates them, and they bend themselves, they compromise, they agree, and they come. Therefore, we have to recognize that the connection between the brothers is work. It's a great additional work. That belongs to the parents. They need to deal with it. They need to awaken them and explain to them in general what it is. Because suddenly in the family there's two people and each of them wants to be king and they don't want the other to exist because it's natural. We see it with Jacob, that one cancels the other, apparently. Therefore, here we have to see, for the parents and also for the brothers themselves, special work in connection between everyone. That the parents, from childhood, from birth onward, of the brothers, twins, to bring them to some special place, mommy, daddy, and two brothers. And here the father has to intervene more. If previously we didn't speak so much about the father intervenes here and there after the breastfeeding period is over. But here, we need a little bit more input from the father. We also need to differentiate between them in such a manner that this is the big one and this is the little one. The little one was born, the other one was born 50 minutes later, you're the big one. It doesn't matter the 50 minutes, you're first. And we learn from the Torah, whoever opens the womb, he's the firstborn. So there's a firstborn and there's a second one. And the firstborn has a certain right, which is bought by through efforts, meaning he's the firstborn. You have to look after your smaller brother. We treat you more than we give you more attention, more respect. But you have to carry out some kind of role, special role. In other words, they're not equal. A person can't stand equality. He doesn't understand that. Equal is one. So I know that this and this is as one. It really has to be together. But if I feel myself I, and he feels himself I, and somebody says about us that we're like one, then we can't stand it. It confuses us because our brain, the way we relate to life, it's always this is more and this is less, close, far, tall, better looking, it doesn't matter what. We have to differentiate between them. And it will already be easier for us. We need to stop comparing them. We need to stop saying all the time, you're brothers. No, you're the big one, you're the little one. That already gets rid of most of the conflicts. Who's first and who's second. It's clear who's first. You're first. You're the big one. And the second one, you're the small one. They need to know this. This is according to nature. It's according to the laws. In all nations, it's accepted. We're just emphasizing this thing. So he was born quarter of a minute earlier and not a few years, but still there's a difference. And we need to respect it. I just want to clarify, you gave an example of twins. I understand from what you're saying that what you're saying is true for brothers. It doesn't matter how much time there is between them, just the opposite. You gave the example of twins, and you're saying even in twins where there's 50 minutes between them,
so
now, if with twins, it's just a more of a problem because we educate them together, we spend time with them together, we take them together to all the places. It's as if we have the same attitude to them. We buy each ice cream, they have the same games. In their mind and feelings, they're the same. There's no difference. So here it's more difficult. I still need to say first you and then him. Give him, he's smaller, and you deserve it because you're bigger. Why is this principle so important? In that I can play around with how they'll treat one another. Why is it important for the big one to know that he's the big one and the small one to know that he's the small one? What does it do for them psychologically? In nature, there's nothing that is equal to another thing. It's us that are confused. And we, through our corrections, have to make everyone equal. But by completing one another, by the corrections that a person does on himself, he reaches a state where the other person is like him. But from the beginning, we have to precisely see the differences. Because then it will be easier for us to reach equality. Therefore, the whole way of correcting humanity, we were equal in the old days in the tribe, and then we go through thousands of years of development where everyone is more or less than the other. In all kinds of perceptions. And then we reach a state where we're all connected and we're in our global world. We're all dependent on one another, and then we have to be equal. But how are we equal? Here we have to work on the equality. Nature from the beginning is bringing us through lack of equality to equality. And in general, how can we put it? A person hates being equal to another. And if we say you're brothers, it's as if we're canceling them. So there's like saying, no, not you, it's the other one. It's like he doesn't feel that he's special. You're smaller, you deserve more, you're bigger, you deserve more. Depends. Everyone deserves what they deserve. And then each feels that he's special. It's a very interesting principle, I have to say. It makes me think. I see the people precisely, not just that, I see the people, I see one is five and the other is three. You're brothers, you have to get along, give him, no. I would even say that we need to emphasize less even that they're brothers. Why is it my fault that I'm his brother? It's not that I wanted it or asked for it or desired it, and suddenly I'm obligated somehow. It has to be obligated through education and not by the fact that our mothers gave birth to both of us, the same mother, the same woman, so I owe him something. I don't feel it. Just the opposite. Between us, there's competition that we came from the same source. Who is closer to this source? Is the mother closer to him or me? There are negative things, and we need to emphasize your brothers. brothers, then I'll kill him. Our ego does not want to suffer another person next to us, especially that we need to divide our mother into half, half for me, half for him, etc. At home also, divide everything half and half. A person can't stand that. I don't want anyone to remind me of that. My parents, the moment that my brother was born, he's 5 years younger than me. Before that, they made a separate room for me. I had a room, but now it was a separate room. And then he was would be closer to them. They compensated for it. They would always make sure that I had that I wouldn't feel that I'm missing something. That I wouldn't feel neglected. When I would go with my father somewhere and play, my mother would look after him. It was quite... I didn't feel that I was rejected. So first of all, I have to say that this principle is really interesting because naturally as parents, we have an inclination to give a feeling like if we buy something, I buy for you and for you. And if I do something, it's for you and for you. There's like a fear to create a fear of neglect. I don't think they feel that you bought something, that you gave them a gift. If the other got the same as me, then I don't feel that it's a present even. It's not a gift. I don't even feel like having it. You need to understand a person's ego. He wants to feel they gave me, they brought me, and suddenly I see he got the same thing. Lost its value. It's very interesting. It's really, I'm just starting to understand what art, especially through differentiating them, he's special in that and he's special in that, great, but they relate to me, they're not comparing me. I don't want to be compared. I'm special. We spoke about it, I think, when we talked about couples meeting each other. When a woman and a man meet, say that you're special. But here it's like it's the foundation. Children, when they're born as brothers, the child doesn't know why he's special. He's small. So actually, there's some work that now I'm starting to understand as a parent that I have to always help the children, help each one in the family to understand how special he is, each one separately. I don't give compliments to one in front of the other. Don't give compliments to one in front of the other, no, unless he truly is special in something. Because in that, I'm automatically harming the other one. I want you to teach me how to do it correctly because I feel that it's a real challenge. It's really simple. There's you and another woman. And a sister. No, it doesn't matter who. It doesn't matter. I didn't choose this brother. And a man comes and says, what a nice haircut you have. You look really nice. Let's get to work. Let's start to work on something together. How do you feel? That I don't want to be part of it. Why? He just... because she got all the attention. You weren't expecting attention, but the fact that you gave related to one person and not the other, then you're harmed. That's why I don't compliment one child in front of another child. That's called harming him. It's as if I'm putting him down automatically. If it gets up, it goes down, and the opposite.
בין הבנות יכול להיות שזה הרבה יותר.
With girls, it could be even worse. Or if there's a boy and a girl, that's a different story. The difference is so natural. It's in nature, so there's no problem. It doesn't awaken jealousy. You don't have to say, you can say to her, you can say to him, you jumped so high, and you can say to her, what a nice hairdo. The others, they can't apply it to the other. Here there's no problem. But if it's two boys or two girls, it's a real problem. And here we need to understand that children are very, very sensitive. And even if I take one and arrange some clothes for him that he really needs, then I also need to pay attention to the other one. That even if I don't, I gave him some attention, I gave him a sign, I gave him a gift compared to the other, that can be a problem. Either we reach through the connection between us and the education, we reach such a place that it's possible. But these things, and this remains with us for life, this we know, that all kinds of things that happen in childhood, mommy did more for him or for her, unless, God forbid, he's sick. Then also we need to take the other to help the mother or the father to treat the sick one. It also has to be a special mission. Now you said something that's really, I run into it a lot with my friends and family. You see kids that had a great connection and they weren't neglected, and they have this confidence. They have a very high self-esteem. Even older people. I have a friend, she's a grandmother today, and when we meet, she tells me 2 or 3 minutes about her grandchild, and then she starts talking about her brothers. It's a feeling of neglect that doesn't disappear. Why is it so strong? Our ego is eternal. Why is there really something in this connection between brothers that is burned so deep in us? Because the Creator obligates me not through corrections, apparently, but by obligating me to love Him. A mother and father, it's one thing. They look after me, so I'm somehow connected, and it's natural for me to return to them what I receive from them when they're older, etc. But him that was born, I didn't invite him, I didn't want him, he's my competitor. Mommy and daddy have to invest in him on my account. If I was alone, I was the king in the family, all of a sudden he came. Here, there has to be a correction, meaning I didn't invite him, I don't need him, and the Creator brought him in. So this anger is truly very big. I feel that the womb, the table, everything has to be divided into two. In the good case, it's half. When there's more kids, it's even easier because then there's a mess. So if there's a lot of kids, it obligates a person to get along. That's a different story. If there's a lot, then he sees that the relationship he has to someone else has between the others as well. And then he learns from others how actually to compromise more. Then there's nothing to divide, really, because the mother belongs to everyone. After two, it's much easier. It's interesting. And afterward, it's just a lot of kids. A lot of kids is no problem. So when there's three, there's the issue of the sandwich child, that you're the big one, you're the small one, and what am I? I'm somehow stuck in the middle. For sure that we have to, we need education. Exactly. I'm a mother with four kids. I understood that you're the big one and you're the small one. Of course, I have to identify the uniqueness of each. What do I do with the middle child? In Israel, there's lots of families with three kids. And the middle child doesn't feel big and he doesn't feel small. He's like in the middle. There's no uniqueness, but I think that the way we're talking, then everyone needs to get an education. You need to connect them with the whole family, the way we spoke of, in such a manner that they'll always feel themselves as completing one another. You mean to build them, let's say I'm a mother of three, I have to build them as like a team, like the big one. Not just that he's the big one, he organizes stuff. The little one brings the joy, the audaciousness. And the middle one, let's say, he brings the middle one usually brings the solidness because he learns from the bigger one. Towards the smaller one, he has to be bigger. And how to treat the smaller one, he learns from the one older than him. So it turns out that he's the most stable. He's actually, if the education is correct, he has to feel, he has to be most successful. It's interesting. He's like, he balances it out. He has to be like the big one to get away from the small one, and that's what pushes him, and he can succeed more. He can succeed more than everyone. The middle one, if we look at it in an egoistic manner, if we feel him not towards that and not towards that, with the correct education, he has the foundations to succeed more than everyone. I think a lot of sandwich children will be happy to hear it because it's the balancing element. I don't think we ever thought about it. How do I, as a mother, start building correctly this connection in the family, this bonding? How do I create it slowly? Which family? Let's say I have three kids. How do I begin to integrate them? And in every situation, how do I create this perception that at this point, this child is special and each one gets their place? First of all, it has to start from birth, even before birth. And from the birth and onward, when we do workshops, round tables, we sit together in our living room, the mother, the father, all the kids, even the one that we're holding in our hands, doesn't matter if the little ones understand or not, they know that this is the order of things, that we sit down and this is what we do, either around a table where we have a meal. It doesn't matter how. But there's some kind of ritual happening. There's a tradition in the family that this is what we do. And then we talk, we ask. It doesn't necessarily have to be like in a workshop, but they're used to having in the family some kind of that we're that we're talking, consulting with one another, we're opening our hearts, we know where we don't know, we're raising doubts, issues, maybe it should be like this or like that. We need to give an example to the kids, and when they get an example, suddenly they start to take things out of themselves. They just need an example, like we always said, that education is through example. So first of all, it's the mother, the father, talking, telling what happened to them in the street, at work. Not just gossip, that's clear, but in a manner that maybe we should feel like this, maybe we should do that. Kids need to get these examples up to where we see they want to speak. They open their mouths. And those that can speak, they still have an urge and they want it. Etc. And in that, here next to the table, we're trying, as we said, like throughout the workshop, we're trying to emphasize that everyone's equal. There's no sandwich, there's no big one or small one. Now, this is interesting. Explain to me. So on the one hand, you're saying show the differences, but then when we were talking, we're equal. Of course, they're equal here in a workshop. And in a workshop, everyone's equal. Equal from what respect? In what respect? That each has the same ability, the same time, the same rights. The same rights. So the equality is the rights. It's not like you have to turn 18 to vote. He's born, he's part of the family. That's it. Doesn't matter, girl, boy, big, small. He has to feel that he's really sitting on my knee, and he can't even walk it. He's sitting, but we need to give him this feeling. Not shut up, give him a pacifier. He needs to truly feel that he's also being involved. He wants to show us something with his hands and feet. It doesn't matter. It's very, very important because this connects him to the family. This is what will tie him in the future as well, that a family for him is that same activity where we sit between us. People didn't just invent for us to eat together, the whole family, in the evening. This, nowadays, it doesn't happen in the evening, but how it used to be. In the morning, he has a cup of coffee with something. During the day, he makes himself a sandwich. And in the evening, you eat with the family. They didn't make it up for nothing, but it was so the whole family would be together around the table and feel that it was a family. So it can be twice a week at least. Of course, on the weekend, it can be an hour or two or more, and eating and all kinds of laughing. And in the middle of the week also, we sit down a bit. No one runs off to their room where they have a game or something, nothing. This is... it has to be so holy in the house that nobody will even think. A child, and also when he's older, no one will even think of doing otherwise. We can check if we determined it as something that's in his life or not, that he'll never even try. He knows that this is above everything. The family time is holy. Now, I, as a mother, I'm trying to imagine myself sitting in a conversation like that, and right away I say to myself, what message do I want to clarify in our discussion today with my kids? Because usually I can tell any story that I want. So the question is, what kind of message I want to convey to the children? It doesn't matter what the message is, as long as it's more or less interesting for everyone. and that each one will say a few words about it. That's it. So you mean I don't have to plan in advance? It's desirable. Something about the issues in the family or the neighborhood or the city, it doesn't matter what. The bicycle broke, it doesn't matter what. Something that can be the general subject. Now, in this discussion, I'm telling them some certain situation. You don't need to tell about a situation. You can whitewash, go over again the laws of the workshop again and again. Like, why when we sit down together, maybe we'll create a situation where today only one person will speak and tomorrow another person will speak. Or each time that we sit down, each of us has to say something. What's better? Let's take it as a subject. Because it has to do with expression, equality, the fact that each one has to feel everyone. Because in a workshop, what does it mean that everyone's equal? That we come out of the workshop as one? How can it be that one person will speak, everyone has to talk, everyone has to participate? During the workshop, we hold hands a bit, or before or after, and we feel that we're really in a connection with the parents and everyone. Meaning there's a process here of connection, of warmth, and its completion. The end has to be, the conclusion has to be that until next time, we've signed a covenant again. And we need to try to do it as emotional as possible and important to such an extent that the kids won't be able to break it, that for them it will be some type of natural border inside them, that above that we don't go. The fact that we belong to the same workshop, the same family, is actually a family. That's the borders of the family. And that remains with us for always. Now let's say that there's a certain attribute I have towards some child. There's a certain child that he gets mad, and there's another child that likes to disturb us more. Do we allow this to be expressed? We don't talk to anyone. We never bring it up. We're completely not allowed to talk about one of the children's attributes. It's important to understand what we're not supposed to do. I don't even want to hear about it, because a person cannot rise above his ego. He's not an attainment. He's not in a psychological, spiritual, such a high level that he can hear in an objective manner, in an objective manner, opinions about himself. No, we're talking about some kind of Moshe, the neighbor from a few blocks down, not even next door. He's like this and this and this. It just so happens that he lives near us, and it has nothing to do with him. And then, in this roundabout way, we express our attitude to that same attribute, how it doesn't look so good to us. But on a complete stranger, to such an extent that he won't even feel that we're talking about him. And we never say to one child, now we're going to talk about someone, but we mean him. God forbid. It has to be really very, very objective. I didn't get it. I'm saying to the oldest child, now we're going to talk about someone, but actually I'm talking to the little one, that for him to learn from it about what he did, that what he did isn't good. We shouldn't say that to the big one, even that the smaller one doesn't hear it. No, because then the older one will understand that we do the same thing to him. It's like manipulations. No. We take, if there was something, I read something, I saw something, take an example from TV, from a movie or something that they're watching in their world, some hero or something, and start talking. Peter Pan or Superman there or something else like that, some duck, it doesn't matter what, some hero. If it's a hero or not. Is that a bear, a hero that he goes in the forest and hits everyone? What's heroic about it and what's not? Where's his aggressiveness, his lack of sympathy, lack of... You can teach a lot like that. Cartoons, they're great for building an education system because they're all rubbish. They're all based on pride and how one cheats the other. And the hero goes and tramples everyone. It's actually, we can awaken in them a philosophical attitude to life and not just... They need to see there's lots of opportunities that on these dolls or on the neighbors aren't so good because it already puts them in some kind of critique. But we need to take examples like this, and on them, we actually speak about them, and God forbid, not about anyone. The recognition of evil has to be on the person himself, like on the big person. We don't say to a person, you're bad, you're doing this and this. We don't judge him ever. We never judge him inside the family. We never judge him. We don't lynch him among five or six family members. How bad he was, and what can we do? Even how to help him? No. He's not a poor person. There's no way to help him. Unless he asks us, then we'll talk about how to help him. Let's say in the middle of the workshop, he says, look, I have a problem like this and like this. So we say to him, how can we help you? But even then, the help has to be in support by encouraging him that he's big and strong and capable and how we support him. We never put anyone in the family down. We're always concerned not to lower their confidence. Can we bring to the family discussion? I'm trying to see how I can, in a creative manner, bring this discussion from another angle. Let's say I read a story and I can do a discussion through that or a small movie, and then we can have a discussion. You have tons of opportunities. Open some book. It doesn't matter what. They get lots of impressions from life. You can go that way. I remember when I was small, my parents, especially my father, used to always read me a story with a lesson. So now, do it during the workshop. I have a question. You said before to be careful the moment we look at some act that someone did, to be careful. You said don't talk about the neighbor because it will make him critical. What does that mean? I didn't understand. The fact that we're doing it, we're being critical, we're looking at something, we're verifying an attribute. We're talking about this attribute, how undesirable it is, not a person, but an attribute. The fact that this attribute is dressed in some person, that's how it appears to us. Maybe anyone who puts someone down is putting himself down. The fact that we see bad in someone else, we're actually seeing bad in ourselves. It's not the end of the verification. Our goal is to verify that a certain attribute is negative. What attribute, for example, being cheapskate, saving money is good, but being cheap is another story. Being generous is a fourth thing. Throwing money around is a third thing. And those things, you know, you can do a lot of discussions about that. And then suddenly the child will begin to understand that it's not just like that. And later when you start to say to him, no, that we can't afford. Daddy's a cheapskate. No. Daddy's saving money. No, but rather the opposite. He wants us to use the money for something else. So daddy is concerned, actually, and logical, etc. You can develop inside him all kinds of forms of perceptions, but don't hang it on people. Don't stick it to people that are known, that he knows. Because then it will remain with him for life. This ant is a cheapskate, and this one is a bit of a witch. That one's sneaky. It's not worth it. We're talking about attributes. Dress those attributes in a person. Tell me about a person who's like this and like that. Let's make a picture like this, or a story. Make a story about someone who's cheap. About anyone. But not about the faults that are easy to see in the family. Say somebody has a stutter, then nobody talks about that. Nobody says, we're going to talk now about a person who stutters when there's a kid next to me who stutters. That's clear. The principle behind it, I understand. It's not just that. There's no such thing that can be changed. We never relate to a person. We always relate to attributes that can be completed and balanced out. Therefore, I don't point to the body. I point to an attribute that can be addressed in someone or not. Meaning we spoke about an attribute and not something that's wrong, not the person carrying the attribute. Otherwise, it turns out that we are gossiping or that we like to gossip. No. I have another question. We can separate between, let's say a person has a certain fault. There's nothing wrong. It's part of him. There's nothing we can do. It's not something, let's say a characteristic, he can learn to use it properly. But if he has something wrong with him, he can't change it. So how do we treat something that's wrong with him? We don't talk about it. Anything that can't be changed and isn't really dependent on me, there's nothing to speak of. Because what's the point? Let's say the child is short or he stutters. That's it. We treat him, even though it takes him 5 minutes to say a sentence, we wait. We wait. Or we start to talk in such a way, in singing, so it'll be easier for him and for us. But truly, we don't correct anyone, but give an opportunity to everyone to discover what needs to be corrected in him, and only with our help and our support, our external support, he'll correct it. I want to. These are laws between people, that's clear, right? not just between kids. There's no difference. Again, I want to get into the issue of criticizing. I understood that we said we shouldn't talk about people that we know because then he'll have stigmas for the rest of his life. Our criticism has to be internal, practical, and it has to be that I'm correcting myself toward that same person that I have criticism about. First of all, by being quiet. I'm quiet. It's not my place to correct anyone. I can only somehow, in some external, very far-off way, help him to get to know the evil in him and correct himself. We're not correcting. Our education is not to correct. Our education is not to discover evil in anyone, even in a child. If he doesn't discover the evil in him, then all my pressure will just be as forcing him, and it won't help. And that I'm not helping him reveal the evil, just the opposite. I'm putting his evil even further in, and it will remain there for life, and he won't be able to correct it. I'm causing him harm for life. What are you saying? It's important to clarify, what does it mean when I pressure him, he has to protect himself? I never say to a child, let's say in an ideal manner, of course, this isn't what usually happens, but in really urgent cases where you can really ruin something, but I never say to a child about bad things, the faults, attributes, negative and not correct, not good, doesn't matter what. I don't say anything. I am silent. First of all, silence and as if nothing is happening. Not that I'm being silent, that he understands that something's not okay. No, as if nothing's happening. And in all kinds of sophisticated ways, I try in a very hidden manner to help him to discover these attributes, these incorrect characteristics, that he'll discover the evil in them, that will hate them, and he'll get away from them. In very, very special cases, I'm looking for examples how to hint to him about his behavior, this or that behavior. And if I see that there's a lot of damage, then I stop him. But here we need to understand that it's not desirable. Can you give me an example? I don't know. Tell me what. I'll give you an example. An example about a negative attribute? No, I want an example for this whole situation. How he goes through it without criticizing the child in a personal and without criticizing the child in a direct manner, without showing him that what he did is not okay, and how he's making up some kind of trick where they're discussing not his behavior but about this attribute, and we succeed not feeling that it's something incorrect, and we also don't put him in to a feeling that I did this whole roundabout to hint about himself. So it looks really impossible because we don't want to shame him. It's like in the group. In the group, we need to cause through our external environment, we need to create thought and attitude that a person will feel what's good and bad, and he'll criticize himself and he'll want to correct himself. That's what the recognition of evil is. What is the recognition of evil? That I come up to you and I say I discover such evil in you? You know why it's hard for me to give you an example? I have lots of examples for everything because I have four kids, but it looks so impossible to implement. I can't think of an example where you'll have a foundation for this simulation. That's why it's finding it hard to bring an example. What does it start with? It starts with certain behavior, negative behavior. We don't give criticism about anyone. Kids and parents don't give criticism to anyone else. Don't criticize anyone else. In general, yes. We're just concerned being looking good in the eyes of others. That's it. Each of us is concerned that others will feel good next to him. I want my family members will be happy that I'm with them, that they gave birth to me, that I exist next to them. I have to reach a situation where when I'm at home, I am a source of good for them, good feeling, good attitude, happiness, a softness, a smile. Let's do exercises like that. Let's start with that. What did you want to say, Nitza? I wanted to say that there's a principle that I'm starting to understand. As parents, we have an inclination to say, today you were a bad, and the next day I can say you were a good boy. Suddenly I understand. You don't need to see a good boy. Suddenly I understand that we shouldn't say that or that because I'm criticizing you. Even when I'm appreciating you, it's positive criticism. Sometimes you can say you were special. That's after some event, that there was some special event, we went together, etc., then we should encourage him. But not, we shouldn't say, today your behavior was bad, not you. No. Only in a special case that we were in a certain place, and then truly you can give him a compliment. So my goal actually, my job as a mother is to cause the brothers the space of the discussion. We have to find inside themselves what's good and bad. Not that I'm pointing out to them what's good and bad, but they have to find it in themselves. That's the big difference. To make a long story short, at the end of the show, that you understand that you have to go through the integral education totally. It's to turn your whole head upside down, yes. But the principle is simple. What is it? The correction is on the person himself, the small person and the big person. And the correction starts from verifying. Don't do bad and do good. And it's to recognize that you're bad and only then to switch to good and to do the good. And all these stages, we mustn't get into a person's inner business. He needs to know himself what's good and what's bad. And gradually we cause him through the family, through the environment. We make sure that he'll get to know what's good and what's bad to such an extent that he'll hate the bad. He'll get away from it and he'll connect to the good. But the whole path is on him. Otherwise, our education isn't worth anything. Otherwise, it's monkeys that you're just hitting them and that's it. We should encourage them, yes, but also gently, that he shouldn't look for whether he's being encouraged or not, that I'm just working for that. No, not for that. Your profit needs to be that you yourself want it to be like that. Not that someone's looking at you and you're only doing it for that. that you're not stealing because somebody can see you or catch you. The evil inclination of a person, that's it. It's all up to the person. We're only the environment. Our time is up. Thank you very, very much, Rav Lightman. Thank you, Nitza. Thank you for being with us. Until next time, all the best. New Life.